Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
It's the Short Coat Podcast, and I'm here with Sunuri Jayatilaka.
Yes.
Did I do it?
Currently, it's Sunuri Layer.
What?
Sunuri Layer.
Layer? Because you're married?
Mm-hmm.
What? That's a lot easier to pronounce, by the way.
I know.
Layer. Lisa Weir.
Hello.
And Eric Wilson.
Hello.
So what's going on, you guys? What's going on in your lives?
We're done being an M3.
Well, some of us are done with M3. Yeah. Sorry,
it's
okay. Lisa.
It's summer, though.
Mm-hmm.
And the sun is out, and it's beautiful.
So what did the end of the year bring you? Because in your M3 year, you're concentrating on, you know,
everything.
Core clerkships.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Sure. So you're talking about, you know, a lot of primary care stuff.
Yep.
So for you, Eric, for instance, what will you be concentrating on? Now you get to do some things that, you know, like take clerkships that weren't prescribed for you. You get to,
that's,
I mean, there
true.
Are still some that you have to take, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now I'm concentrating on family medicine stuff. So
you're not going to be like,
that's really everything.
You're not going to be all into you're not going to be taking, like, you know, advanced critical care, advanced life support or anything.
No, a lot of primary care stuff, doing a little bit of research and really just enjoying fourth year is the big plan.
What about for electives?
Electives, I'm doing one OA elective just in family medicine in California, where my wife matched for residency. And
how convenient.
Yes, very, very convenient.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a research elective and... I'm doing the teaching elective in the spring.
Oh.
Excited about that.
That's cool.
And then probably doing the writing humanities elective as well.
Very good.
So, a lot of fun stuff.
I approve. What about you, Sunuri?
I'll be doing internal medicine. And then for electives.
Boring.
No, it's so much cool. It's a lot of coolness.
All right.
I'm really excited. I'm doing clinical endocrinology in my sub-internship. I have a research elective. I'm going to the Himalayas for global health.
Cool.
Yeah. And then lots of time off.
Okay.
That's number one
really,
thing.
Yeah.
A lot of time off.
Yeah.
have you had your counseling sessions with your faculty or dean yet? Eric has.
As you know.
Eric, what do you think? Did you hear anything new during that? Did you?
No. But I guess, again, because my wife already went through the whole process last year, I kind of had a little bit of a head start. And so.
So Sunuri hasn't had hers yet. Give her some counseling right now.
On what to expect.
Yes. Tell her, no, give her some, as though you were the faculty. What would you say to Sunuri about, you know, matching and all that kind of stuff? All the stuff that you were told.
At my meeting?
At your meeting.
Just have fun, enjoy it, be yourself.
That's what you were told?
Yeah, kind of. I kind of had everything in line already, so it's kind of all that was left was, well, enjoy your time off. But
we spent eight hours on your letter, and that's what you were told?
Actually, I don't have great advice for you.
You probably had a good letter, so you didn't have one of those that... You didn't have one of those that they needed to, like, sit you down and say, okay.
Well, I mean, you put it together, Dave.
So we want to be an ophthalmologist.
No, that's one of, you know, family medicine has a lot of benefits. It's a great, great specialty. But one of them also is that there's a lot of programs and they kind of like well-rounded people and people of various interests. And so, yeah, I think I fit the mold of family medicine of not really being mold. So I'm excited for that.
Very good.
Same with internal medicine.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I had one of the meetings with Jill a few days ago. And
She's the person who comes in and she's a consultant, match consultant.
Uh-huh. And before this, like, all of her advice that I've seen in, like, group settings had been terrifying. But, like, with me, she was like, you have nothing to worry about.
So what was the terrifying bits that you remember from the...
from other things?
Yeah.
Previous sessions, probably.
Let's terrify Lisa.
Oh, you have to do so many, like, 60 interviews and... have to do away rotations.
Oh yeah,
just a lot of yeah.
There's always moments of panic for students. I think in the first couple of years when they start looking and they see these like board score averages and research numbers of research that people have done and all these things, and some of that stuff is horribly inflated as well, I think. Like research publications and things, but it's really nerve-wracking until you get into it and kind of until you know what you want to do, and then you can really focus on what's important for you, and I think that helps settle things down a little bit.
Yeah.
Unless you want to go into like ophthalmology or something. I mean,
yeah, then you better have your board scores, and you better have your publications, and you better look freaking awesome.
I guess. I wouldn't know.
That's nice.
We kind of already talked about it, but one thing that Sinari and I were talking about is just kind of the state of transition and going into fourth year and how exciting it is. And we've already hit on it, but there's definitely, when I clicked submit for my test today, there was definitely a feeling of like release for me. Just, it's over. I can now focus on other things. My life is about to get a lot better, even though third year is a lot better even than second year, I thought. But
yeah, definitely would agree with that.
I've heard fourth year is the promised land.
Kind of, yeah. Kind of
vacation
is.
And whatever you want.
It kind of is, because then you can really focus. You can return the focus, I think, more to what interests you, or just, you know, take some time off or something like that.
I think it's a hard time of transition though, because you go through so much time in the winter where you don't actually interact with like patients, and then suddenly at the end of fourth year you're supposed to start taking care of people. And
yeah, I would say, you know, if you're going to take some time off, you might want to spread it out.
Yeah,
you know, so that you don't, I don't know, lose your mojo.
Yeah, but I think that'll be an interesting thing to deal with over the next year.
That's true.
Of course.
Which means I should probably not do CS at the very end, which is the clinical skills
yeah.
exam.
Yeah.
I didn't think of that.
See? See, we're doing all sorts of good here today. What did you learn in your third year? So now that if you could sum up your third year, what was the most important thing you learned?
Patient care. I mean, we learned how to really take care of patients and be able to communicate with patients and then report it back to other, like your coworkers, and do that well so you can get good transition of care.
I think the thing, you know, from what I've read, one of the things people struggle with the most is those presentations in front of or to, you know, your colleagues and, you know, the residents and all that kind of stuff about, you know, your patients.
Yeah, I definitely like worked on that. Was my hardest part, because I'm slower and I take longer. Like I do the
She's
longer kind.
Slow.
I do the longer presentations. So just making it short and succinct, and
that's a struggle.
That was the hard part.
Yeah, I remember that being even later in the year, as you switch residents, switch attending, you know, it completely different. Each person wants a different thing, and you do your awesome presentation that worked great last week, and this one says, no, this is the way you do
it.
And definitely the first time around for everybody is a disaster for each time that you switch people you're presenting to, but you get used to it in the end, and I think maybe...
Don't they tell you, though, you know, okay, this is what we want for, you know, anesthesia? I don't know. Do they do this for the anesthesia? I don't know.
It's person dependent is how they like it.
All right.
Yeah.
Some people don't want you to go into all the like vital signs. They just rather you interpret it. Whereas some people are like, no, I don't care. Don't do any interpretations. Tell me straight on what you found. Don't skip things. And then other people are like, skip things. I don't want to hear all of it. Just tell me the pertinent stuff. Or, you know, it's just different.
It changes. Yeah. But I think that actually, I mean, patient care, of course, is a huge thing. I think flexibility is really the third year thing that I got, or one of the things I got the most out of it was just learning to be flexible and switching every day. I mean, I just got off OB, and every day or every half day we were switching clinics and had different concerns, different ways to present, different staff we're working with. And we really just have to get in the mode of being flexible and just kind of being ready for anything. And that's how it's going to be in the real world. And especially going into family medicine, it's going to be like that. So...
How do you deal with sweat when you're doing these presentations? Because if I was doing these presentations, I would be sweating like a pig out of sort of nervousness, embarrassment, all of that kind of stuff. I guess that white coat helps cover it up a little bit. But I would be just nervous beyond belief my first time.
Yeah, I mean, usually, like, I don't know. For the first few times, yeah, I tend to sweat just because I sweat with any, like, public speaking. But then I'm like, I don't care after that. And then it's not a problem.
Yeah, white coat has been an important barrier for me between my personal secretions and the outside.
He had especially lined with plastic.
Yeah. Especially when it's like morning, and recently I've been biking into school because it's been nice out, and I get here and I'm just drenched in sweat already, and then I have to go and then present. And using the white coat is both like a smell and perspiration barrier has been important. I'm not afraid to admit it, but I do have to take some time to cool down. But yeah, it's just I think the hardest part, or the biggest thing, is just spitting it all out. You just have to, like, if people try to interrupt you, you just have to like push forward head first and just keep going and just spit everything out and then be like, I'm done. And then they can they can add what they want, they can tear you apart, but you know what, you're done, so you don't have to say anything else. And that's probably the most important thing. You don't want to be sitting there for half an hour waiting to get the last little bit out. Just get it all out.
Oh, I hate interruptions. Some people like to interrupt. That's really annoying.
So when you're doing these, you're sort of, I don't know, I picture you like in a hallway outside of a patient's room, like in a group, presenting your thing to presenting your patient to the other people in your group, right? Which could include medical students and real doctors and attendings and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So as a medical student, you must be really excited not to have to go first.
Sometimes it's better to go first. You mean like to be the first
to be the first to do their presentation that day?
Sometimes it's, if it's the very first day of with that staff, I always tried to go first
because
they have no expectations.
Yeah.
If you want to set the expectations really low, right, for yourself.
Yeah.
And that's something that you're good at. So good. And then there's personality. So I picture you, both of you, as being sort of, I mean, you're not what I would call like extroverts. Do you think? You think I'm right?
Yeah, I mean, I get along with everyone.
Do you think it's easier for an extrovert than for an introvert? Actually, I picture none of you three as extroverts.
Nope.
No.
Not an extrovert at all.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, I come on this podcast a lot, though.
Although I feel like we're shutting you down a little bit right now.
No, it's okay. But I don't have anything interesting to talk about, so.
Well, I mean, you know, you can ask questions, too. I'm not the only one.
It's true.
And it's always good to put forth your opinions, even if they don't have any basis on experience.
We don't worry about that sort of thing.
Exactly.
So do you think the extroverts have an easier time of it, or are they just as...
I think so. So I would say I'm closer to being an introvert than an extrovert, but I'm not completely.
Okay.
So I can like put myself out there and get along just fine with certain groups of people if I feel like it's fine, but others I just don't care to want to get along with, or like I'll get along with, but I just don't want to really put myself out there. So I'll be quiet most of the time.
Did you get so if you were quiet, did you get dinged for it?
No.
Because I've read
that's
comments.
That's what I've heard too, and that's what I'm most afraid of.
I've read, yeah.
Getting in trouble because I'm too quiet.
Because I've read comments like, you know, really seems to know her or his stuff, but doesn't speak up, and so it's difficult to decide whether they really do or not.
I guess I've heard that people have said that I'm shy, so try to be not so shy and like speak up more. So, but that's usually in like a midterm thing, and then I then do my best to not be quiet.
I feel like you could have taken that quote you said, Dave, probably verbatim from some of my evaluations. Like, you would have spoken up more, we would have known more about him. But yeah, I've had comments like that. I tend to be more of a quiet person and more of a listener as opposed to a talker. But I mean, sometimes you just, there's nothing you can do. When I was on internal medicine, there was a couple of weeks where I decided to make a conscious effort of being more vocal and more talkative, and I still got the same comment at the end of the time saying, if you would just talk a little bit more. So I think my perception of what's being vocal and their perception is very different. But then they add in something like, patients seemed to be comfortable with him, so probably did okay. So that can always help
fantastic.
Too.
That's fantastic. I think it's kind of I don't know what somebody is supposed to do with that sort of comment, because like you say, like you implied just now, that's kind of like asking you to be, I don't know,
something other than
what you are, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, that kind of makes the assumption that we should all end up being the exact same kind of doctor. And that's just, I mean, not feasible, first of all, but not everyone wants the same doctor. I don't know that I really want someone who's all like chirpy, happy, come in, like, come tell me everything about your life. And I'm just like, be calm. It's okay. we can just be quiet.
Well, I guess the problem though is that, as I said, they can't judge what you know if you're being too quiet.
It's true.
also when you have talkative doctors, then they talk the whole time and you can't get a word in about what your complaint is.
Yes. I
find that really annoying.
It hurts.
Yeah, it's the worst when both the staff physicians and the residents have, like, diarrhea of the mouth and they just can't stop. You know, it's like they take turns, like, repeating each other, take turns interrupting each other. And as a student, you don't feel like you have power, so you don't want to be the one to, like, overtalk them. But eventually you get used to it and you just learn to do it and be like, hey, I've got something to say. It might not be right or important, but I'm going to say it anyway.
How do you judge the importance of what you're going to say?
You learn that over time, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the patient care thing. Like if your patient's in severe respiratory distress, you learn very quickly. That's something you want to tell them about. Yeah. But for other things...
I don't know if you guys noticed, but he's not breathing.
there have been situations similar to that when this past year.
Excuse me, it's hard to stop. All right. Has stuff like that come up where you felt like you had to speak up about something that's going on and that people weren't quite paying attention to?
It wasn't as urgent for me, but yeah, there are times like when I would have just talked to the patient so I know something new that they don't, but then it's hard to like interrupt what your attending and your residents are talking about and maybe even contradict them with this new information.
That's gotta be tough. Although I have read some comments where people are like, where, and I'm guessing it's a resident, but it could be an attending as well. It could be, and they say something like, he or she taught me something, or he or she noticed something that I didn't notice, and that's cool. Kind of thing. So you never know.
Yeah.
Might as well speak up.
I think it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. There's definitely, most of the times it's been, there's a couple instances, both in my experience and also with students that I was working with, where it was really related to like inpatient pain control, where there was the residents were so busy with all of their patients because they have like 8 to 10 or more people to follow, and students have like 1 or 2. So we go and sit with them and we're like, you know, I think they're in a lot of pain, but the residents have other things to do. And then they kind of forget about bumping up their pain control. And that was the biggest thing that I saw was kind of frustrating, where multiple hours go by trying to say like, you know, I really think they need more of this or something, mm-hmm. and nothing really to get done. But
yeah.
I don't blame it on anybody really. It's just kind of the workload and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree. Sometimes patients like need just small, simple things, and like pain or extra, like a diet order, you know, because they want to eat after an NPO. Just getting that through when reminding your resident about it, it helps patients.
Yeah.
And residents are doing a gazillion things, so it's easy to forget.
Why don't they just give out the buttons to everybody, the pain button, the morphine button? I know, that's probably a terrible idea. Forget I suggested it. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
The Art of Medicine podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
We're back on the Short Code Podcast. Hey, this came across my feeds this week, and I thought we would talk about this. It's actually kind of old news, so if you've heard about it before, I apologize, but I thought it would be kind of an interesting topic because a professor at Syracuse wrote a piece for a bioethics journal. I think it was actually called Bioethics. Anyway, I'll put the link on the website. He wrote a piece about when he became paralyzed in the late 1970s and his visit in the hospital to recover and get rehab, I guess. And he talks about how in his particular hospital, which was at Northwestern, there were something called, quote, head nurses. And these nurses, not all of them, but these nurses appeared to take it upon themselves to, I don't know, sexually rehabilitate the patients. We read this article just before the show today, and I think we all kind of felt like we were watching a sex scene with our parents while we read it in each other's presence. But anyway, I thought we would talk about this because it brings up a couple of interesting issues. I thought, you know, we've got the ethics of what these nurses were allegedly doing. We have the whole concept of rehabilitation patient and what that means and what patients might like it to mean. We have the concept of, you know, for this doctor who was 18, or for this professor who was 18 at the time, what he thought his needs were in terms of rehabilitation. And then we have the actual essay itself, which seems to be just a little bit objectifying of the people involved. So anyway, Lisa, you read this.
I did.
What were your first uncomfortable thoughts?
So I worked as a nursing assistant for a really long time. And by really long time, I mean like 4 years, uh-huh. Which in my life is a long time. And I will just say my very first thought that I was like, whoa, was the fact that this happened after he had urinated himself and she was cleaning himself up, and I was like, that is just the worst time to do that. I cannot fathom. And
we should mention that. So the deal was this, and apparently in the essay, he said he didn't believe what he was being told by his fellow patients, but that, you know, there would come a time, he was told by the other patients, that when you rang your bell in the middle of the night, a nurse would respond, and would respond in a way that was especially exciting. and he was like, whatever, I don't believe it. But apparently he said it turned out to be true. So, well, yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to ring your bell for something.
It's true. I don't know. There's also this concept of, I think it would be really difficult to work if I were in that, like, nursing environment of, you know, thinking that was an expectation. But maybe that's just me in this day and age. Maybe it's different back then. I don't know. I mean, I worked in psychiatry, and you get a lot of patients that are kind of, they have lost some of their inhibition and will say and do things that are not really appropriate. And so I was always somewhat uncomfortable and kind of dealing with that. But I also, it was very accepted / encouraged that, you know, you tell them that you don't do that kind of stuff. But obviously that didn't happen here. And so
I think that, though, it wasn't that it was an I don't get the sense from this that it was an expected part of one's work, but that it was something that individuals took upon themselves as, I don't know, was it a mission? What was it?
I don't know.
Was
it like a dare?
Was it
a nursing workroom?
Yeah. Was it a some sort of deviance? Was it just like, you know, we should really be doing this for the benefit of our, it's unclear to me what the point was for these nurses, especially. It's pretty clear what the point was for Professor Peace here.
I feel like that's
his actual name, by the way. I'm not making a weird joke. His name is William Peace.
Well, we also got a response to this article written by someone.
Rachel Barina from bioethics.net.
Yeah.
It was printed on bioethics.net.
And I think the response kind of addresses some of your questions. I mean, it raises some of the similar questions, like, what was the point of this? Was this actually a consensual act? Was this, you know, just kind of pointing out that the article, or the piece itself, written by
Peace.
didn't really address all of these like power issues and concerns. It really seemed like reminiscing back to the good old days when, you know, you could still get fully rehabilitated.
that is like
without addressing kind of, you know, things have changed.
It's like the worst euphemism ever.
Wow, it's like, you know, they talk about the whole patient, the experience now. Clearly we have not been paying attention to the whole patient.
Yeah. But it just kind of harkens back to a time when, I mean, women really didn't have power, essentially. I mean, even now, you know, the power differentials between men and women in many situations are just kind of incredible. But this is in 1978, yeah. And I feel like it's not acknowledging, it's more acknowledging, in his view, it seems like he thought that was awesome and amazing, but he doesn't really address all these concerns. And
he was 18 at the time. I mean, you know.
He was, but he's writing this as a 50-some-year-old. Looking back on that time, and yeah. I mean,
The first thing I thought when I saw it was like, wait, I could get in trouble if I ever did that. Like, that is totally inappropriate and not being professional at all. So I was more thinking of the power differential between, like, you being the nurse and, like, your patient has less power than you. First of all, he's completely dependent on you for pretty much everything. And like, it would be you as a nurse taking advantage of the patient. Whereas in the response, I think it was going the other way, that it was an expectation for men, like that they have the higher power than the nurses. And I had been looking at it the other way, as like a professional, which I think that's the way it's viewed nowadays. Mm-hmm. Like usually it's in any type of court system, like a professional person with the patient, like that power is obviously the doctor has right. the higher power than the patient.
Right.
I definitely saw it that way too. And I think the response also brings up this idea of kind of still, you know, it's just objectifying women, and it's just presenting women as, you know, it doesn't talk about having a lasting relationship with the nurse because of the excellent nursing care she performed, you know, not the fact that she cleaned him up after he urinated himself, but rather the fact that she performed this sexual favor after having cleaned him up. And I think that was kind of their concern. And also, I mean, something that went through my head, just kind of wondering what was the point, like, and also thinking, you know, if this is something that actually happened, I mean, I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with reporting things that happened. If it's truth and you're bringing something to light, but at the same time, what was the point? And I think he started out on the right path of talking about sexuality with people with disabilities and kind of talking to his neurologist saying, am I going to be able to have sex again? It's an important question that we as doctors should be able to at least address in some way. But then he kind of took it down this path of being like just a story of his time in rehabilitation and really didn't go anywhere with it.
He got laid, baby. That was like the whole, I don't know, it just felt like he could have structured his essay in a way so as to deal with the concept or the issue in a, I don't know, more mature. I mean, I get that he was 18 when he experienced this, but yeah, like you say, he's now 50, in his 50s. He did say that he had forged a lifelong friendship with this woman, one that lasted until her death 2 years ago. So that's nice.
Yeah.
Do we, I mean, what kind of... is, you know, so sexuality, you guys get stuff on human sexuality, and you know it's part of your training, you know, does what I don't even know what I'm going to ask about this. Like, what I can't even say, you know, is this sort of thing addressed? No, of course not. You know, don't do this with your patients. They're all nodding.
That's basically, you know, what we...
We're told not to do that. Dave, you idiot. I don't even know.
I think a lot of the problems with pieces like this or other things that cause outrage, which is one thing we were talking about before recording, is just kind of this cyclical outrage that occurs over various things that pop up in the media. But it's just the things that cause outrage sometimes are things that are just not very well done. So they're just done, you know, that's maybe one judgment of the quality of a piece or something. But it's also kind of, I guess, just thinking out loud here, kind of a product of its time too, because I started thinking about like The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman, and that's kind of like a coming of age story of a young man with an older woman, and that movie is considered to be like kind of a classic movie, but it came out a long time.
Absolutely a classic movie, yeah.
But you know, if it was made at the same time, would we view it? If it was made today, would we view it the same way?
If it was made today, it would be made by Seth Rogen, and probably would be, you know, kind of gauche.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and you know, the fact that this is, I mean, the interesting thing about this for me is that it came up in my feed like yesterday, and but it happened, this article by Peace, William Peace, came out at least a year ago, I think. And as you say, these things are sort of cyclical, so they, you know, they happen and then they go away, and then the internet finds them again, and it comes back into your feed, and you know, people get outraged, and then it goes away, and then it comes back, and yeah, no, I think there's something to what you say about, you know, if it had been done well, if the essay had been written well, you know, maybe we wouldn't be talking about this, and maybe Northwestern wouldn't have. By the way, Northwestern's not happy about this article, by the way, because they feel like it puts them in a poor light, even though it happened, you know, 40 years ago.
Say, I'm guessing the editor of this journal got a talking to of some sort.
Yeah, well, they weren't gonna let them. They initially wanted them to retract, or you know, do whatever they do in the internet age to take something back.
You can't really retract.
Eventually, I think they came to some sort of understanding about in printing it. I mean, it was a long time ago. But yeah, I mean, and it also, and then this is the other issue, is that, you know, if we think of this as art, you know, this essay as a piece of art, or alternately as a piece of journalism, i.e. a relation, you know, relating a story that actually happened in the past, then what right does Northwestern have to say that, you know, it can't be published in this bioethics journal? And this is something I think about actually with this podcast, you know, kind of all the time. Like, what is the line to walk when you could potentially, you know, accidentally embarrass your parent organization? You know, it's kind of something to think about. I don't know if they.
Well, I think we've already firmly established that the University of Iowa does not has taught us to act professionally in all ways, yes, at all times.
Yes, so. This is why I have avoided many jokes today that I could have made, and that's why this show is not as funny as it might otherwise be.
I want to kind of take that along to another story that I heard, I don't know, like a year or maybe two ago. It was after the Boston Marathon. It was like a few months after that, or maybe several months. But it was about, it was like a love story in a paper about this nurse, about a new marriage between the nurse that took care of one of the runners that got hurt, and like this love story and how they fell in love while she was taking care of them, and or him, and
that sounds vaguely familiar. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it was, they like, so the paper took it on as the love story and how
feel good, yeah.
Yeah, like nice and
something
sweet,
good came out of this horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that reading it, it reminded me of how, like, from all the World War stories, you know, of nurses taking care of soldiers and then falling in love with them and like happy endings after that. But it made me think of like the women's role, I guess, at that time was thought to be nurturing and then to then fall in love with the person, the guy that you're taking care of. And I was surprised about it happening like now. And again, we're taught to never like fall in love or, you know, or go into that situation.
Not to, you don't want to become too involved with your patients.
Mm-hmm. And then if you feel like that's happening, then you need to like retract yourself, yeah, from whichever situation, either not be there, they not be your patient, or
because you lose your objectivity, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, and you lose your,
yeah.
I just want to interrupt here. We have this new podcast set up with you know, this podcast cart here, and there's a giant computer on top of it, and Scenario is like peeking over the top of it all.
It
I think I'm gonna have to change things. This is too much. Anyway, yeah, you want to keep yourself from being too, you know, overly, you want to keep your relationship from being overly complicated, mm-hmm, basically, and preventing you from
giving good care.
You're right.
So, I mean, the paper never went into any of what happened, like, or the story during the care. They kind of avoided that and, like, talked about afterwards. But I just wondered, like, if there'd be reactions to that. And I never followed up on it to see if there were, but I was just...
I think probably the fact that you didn't see it run across your stupid Facebook feed, like, people like, I can't believe...
Yeah, you know, I didn't hear any conversations about it. I just, you know, I thought about that and...
I guess all's well that ends well, but if it hadn't ended well, you know, if the relationship hadn't ended well, maybe there would have been more to
hear. I mean, that sounds kind of like, I remember reading that article, but it was a while ago. Yeah. And, you know, maybe that's a healthcare love story done right. I mean, who knows? You know, maybe it was like, they met each other, they liked each other, because, you know, what's to say that if they met each other out on the street, mm-hmm, randomly without having that relationship, you know, they could have still met each other and fell in love.
Yeah.
So long as it's not, you know, so long as, like you said, you choose either to be in a relationship with them or their provider, you don't do both, then it's kind of a, I don't know. I mean, that's a tough balance, though.
Yeah. Is objectivity really all that important, though? I mean, you know, we spend a lot of time like fretting about the doctor-patient relationship and how it should be, you know, sort of, you know, at arm's length and all that kind of, and I'm not saying, you know, everybody should get, you know, sexy time in the hospital or whatever, but, you know, like, you know, let's just take a step back from that whole issue and bring it to, you know, developing friendships with your patients and, you know, being involved with their lives in ways that, I mean, is that so bad?
Well, see, that's what I always think of, not that necessarily like getting in relationships with patients is absolutely a great idea, idea. But how, like, is anyone can be completely objective? And I think about this more because I come from a really small town where, you know, like, the doctor knows everyone in some capacity. Like, here in Iowa City, you can have a doctor that you only see as a doctor, and you maybe walk past in Hy-Vee once, and that's about it. But when you live in a small town, it's like, you know, you're the doctor, and you're taking care of the librarian, and you're taking care of your kid's teacher, and you're taking care of your priest, and everyone else. Like, you know everyone in some capacity relatively well, so you can't necessarily stay extremely objective. I mean, you can try, but like we have biases that we just can't get rid of.
So. And you're also an important part of the community. You're a part of, you know, this fabric of your community in a small town.
Yeah,
like
in a small town, they don't trust you either. Like, if you tried to stay completely like, I can't know anyone, everyone would be like, well, I don't want to go see you. Like, you're that standoffish Dr. Hermit, you know, so.
I think, yeah, that's definitely the impression I get at, like, the university hospital. Not that everybody's like this or anything, and people do form really deep connections with their patients, but there's a lot more kind of objectivity. Kind of, it's an anonymous patient coming to you. You just know their health concerns and you try to treat that. But when I was on my family med rotation in Guttenberg, I was just kind of amazed that, you know, they're very integrated in the community, and that everybody that they're treating are people they know and people they've been friends with for a long time. And I think that's probably a skill you develop over time as much as your medical knowledge, just how to balance those personal relationships with the medical relationship, and making sure, probably the key is to make sure you don't treat people differently just because one of them is a very close friend and the other one is just an acquaintance. And so making sure you're not spending hours with one person and minutes with another.
I think it could also, like, improve your care too, you know, when you come up with a treatment plan or something, knowing if that's feasible for this person to do. Or maybe you have an elderly person and you're like, oh, well, I know this pharmacist will set up your meds in this way and that can be helpful for you. And, you know, knowing more what they need and where to find those exact resources could be helpful.
I think I'd rather be a rural doc just because of this issue, just because I think it would be a lot more fulfilling to have a personal connection with the people you were responsible for caring for.
Mm-hmm. And it is, seems more like a friendly environment. The doctor's place isn't this obscure, like, place that you go to get your health care and, like, try to keep it private from everyone else. I mean, it's still private, but it's friendlier. You see people you know, and the doctor obviously knows everyone. And each time, like, when I was in family med, I was in a private clinic, and he would literally know everyone from, like, church, from the store, from, you know, wherever. And he's known them for years. And, like, they just start off the conversation from wherever they left off the last time they had met. And it was just interesting. It was weird for me because I had no idea what was going on, like, conversation-wise. Yeah, it was hard to, like, get into that. But you could see that there was an established relationship there. Cool.
I think that kind of changes your perspective on kind of, like you said, more private things with your healthcare. I mean, like, at the university here, we get a lot of, you know, don't want to see a student either because they just don't feel like being seen by a student, which is fine, but, or maybe they work at the hospital and they don't want to be seen by their coworkers.
I gotta say, for me, it depends on the problem.
Yeah, so exactly. And that's what I'm talking about is for the more kind of sensitive issues, you know, whether it's like a pelvic exam or usually it revolves around, like, genital exams. Yeah. just to be honest.
If I ever have a problem with hemorrhoids, though, you guys are.
Yeah. But
Come on in, boy.
You know, I've thought about that a lot as far as what I would want in my healthcare and whether I want to keep people out or let people in. And I feel like the family doctor that I worked with, I mean, he knew these people, but yet he had to take care of all of their problems. And they were really open with having a student there and learning. And I think that was because they had someone they trusted and knew that, you know, they had been trusting with these problems for a long time. And they really maybe had more trust in their healthcare providers than you might have if you have a more distant relationship. I mean, that's kind of just speculating too, but
I guess the other side of the professionalism coin, though, is, or the professional distance coin, is, you know, protecting oneself emotionally as the provider when things go wrong. Mm-hmm. Valid or invalid, you know, point of view that is, it's probably something that, you know, one thinks about.
And I've also read, you know, critiques on end of life care and stuff when you're really close to your patients, like, will you know when the right time is to tell the family, like, you know, this is probably the point where, you know, we should go to a different method of care, you know, kind of hospice palliative type stuff. And knowing that line, like, would it change if you were really close to them? And would you feel like you know, after the fact that maybe you did more harm because you just couldn't let go.
Don't you think, though, that with that particular conversation, it's going to come down, don't you think it's going to come down more to what you feel your role is in general on and in the end of life? I mean, because I think probably maybe doctors come down on both sides of that. Like, my goal is to help them feel as comfortable as possible and to ease their passage, versus my job is to keep them alive at all costs. I mean, I would imagine that, you know, it's largely dependent on the views of that physician rather than the circumstances of that person. Or am I?
I'd like to think so. I think it tilts one way or another, but it's definitely more difficult to deliver bad news to someone you care about and are close to than someone that is just a person.
Oh, yeah. And I just remembered there was something I read about, you know, a number of physicians who don't tell their patients that they have cancer. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, because it's bad, basically what it boils down to, it's bad news, and they don't tell them right away, which you would hope that they would, but apparently a large number don't. So what it didn't address was whether the doctors knew their patients or not, or were close to their patients or not. But
yeah,
well, I feel like we've passed another lovely 45 minutes together. Thank you so much. What are you going to do this coming week, Lisa?
I don't know. My boyfriend
has
clinical beginnings next week, and then he goes to Des Moines for a year. So I think just hanging out with a bunch of people who are coming back after studying for step one and finishing that and having fun.
Okay. Well, good. That's what I like to hear. We will start the credits, apparently. If you like what you heard on the Short Code Podcast this week, go ahead and visit us at theshortcode.com and leave us a message. We could use some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. That would be pretty sweet. And the podcast is brought to you by a generous donation by the Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox. Our closing music is by C2C. Executive producer Jason Lewis. I'm Dave Eller. We'll talk to you in a week.